available on digital media, iTunes podcast, smartphone apps, and from the online website. This is Outlook, the talking newspaper for Coventry.
Hello from me, Nigel Hewin, and welcome to this week's edition of Outlook, being recorded on Wednesday, the 1st of October, 2025. And in this edition, Elaine is going to go to Newbold-on-Avon. We're continuing the story about cheese, this week about English cheeses. We're finding about how a peace movement became a street war, from Old History by Pete. There's facts about Coventry you've never knew before. We think you never knew before, but you'll find out later. There's a bit more from Dictionary Corner with Susie Dent. And we're going to end with a View Bridge Railway, that's a miniature railway at Russell's Garden Centre with Dave. But there's also, of course, the news from the Hub, the sport, and your post bag. But as ever, we're going to start with a synopsis of the local news together with Anne and Peter.
Outlook News.
News that Jaguar Land Rover manufacturing operations will resume in the coming days has been described as a light at the end of the tunnel for the car giant and its connected supply chain. The company has been working to get its online systems back up and running since a devastating cyber attack that halted worldwide operations 4 weeks ago. In recent days, JLR has announced several sections of its digital platforms are up running again, meaning a backlog of payments worth thousands of pounds can be cleared and some manufacturing operations can start again soon. The announcements come as the government revealed plans for a £1.5 billion loan, which would allow JLR to bring some financial relief for its badly impacted supply chain. Dr. Charles Tennant, a local automotive analyst, said these are positive steps which show the company is moving in the right direction after what has been a very challenging period. At last, it appears that JLR are about to restart some of their production operations as they continue to deal with this devastating cyber attack, Dr. Tennant said. This will bring some welcome relief to the supply chain. Clearly there is much more work to do as JLR switches their complete IT systems back on. But it looks like we may be seeing light at the end of the tunnel after this very challenging period. A JLR spokesman said last Monday, "As the controlled, phased restart of our operations continues, we are taking further steps towards our recovery and return to manufacture of our world-class vehicles. Today, we're informing colleagues, retailers and suppliers that some sections of our manufacturing operations will resume in the coming days." This comes days after the company announced that sections of its digital platforms were up again, which meant it was able to clear the backlog of payments of some £300 million. But, while there's obvious progress, bosses are keen to point out it's a process that requires time and caution.
Coventry City Council has backed UK health bosses after US President Donald Trump made bizarre claims that taking paracetamol while pregnant heightens the risk of autism in babies. The comments prompted backlash around the world, with both the NHS and the Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency rubbishing the claims. Dr. Alison Cave, Chief Safety Officer at the MHRA, said in response, "Patient safety is our top priority. There is no evidence that taking paracetamol during pregnancy causes autism in children. Paracetamol remains the recommended pain relief option for pregnant women when used as directed. Pregnant women should continue to follow existing NHS guidance and speak to their healthcare professional if they have questions about any medication during pregnancy. Untreated pain and fever can pose risks to the unborn baby, so it is important to manage these symptoms with the recommended treatment. Our advice on medicines in pregnancy is based on rigorous assessment of the best available scientific evidence. Any new evidence that could affect our recommendations would be carefully evaluated by our independent scientific experts. We continuously monitor the safety of all medicines, including those used during pregnancy, through robust monitoring and surveillance. We encourage anyone to report any suspected side effects to us via the yellow card scheme.
OVO Energy is distributing complimentary energy saving items as part of a £56 million winter assistance programme. The programme encompasses complimentary electric blankets, smart sockets and household efficiency kits. Additional assistance available from OVO include complementary energy improvements such as loft insulation or a replacement boiler or heat pump. There is also enhanced financial assistance for those experiencing difficulties such as direct debit reductions, emergency credit top-ups and extended repayment plans. The assistance from OVO is technically available throughout the year, but applications for enhanced winter support will open in October. OVO has delivered £190 million in assistance since 2022 and has helped 42,000 customers. Dave Buttress, CEO of OVO, said, "We're providing support to those who need it most by working together with our charity partners and committing our largest ever customer support package. But this isn't a long-term solution. We need to make the energy system work better for everyone. That starts with targeted support in the form of a social tariff. No one can be, or no one needs to be, left behind." Vicky Brownridge, CEO at Step Change Debt Charity, said, "We're pleased to continue our partnership with OVO, which will provide much needed support to customers struggling with energy bills throughout the colder months. We know that the past few years have been challenging for households facing significant cost of living pressures. OVO's extra support will help thousands of people access advice and support with energy arrears and wider financial difficulties. We look forward to working closely with OVO on this important initiative." Fresh research from OVO shows that 91% of individuals are anxious about their bills this winter, while 71% report feeling more concerned compared to last year.
The NHS has issued an update on the latest COVID symptoms to be aware of, as well as guidance on what to do if you contract the virus. With the change in seasons, many people are already experiencing runny noses, sniffles and coughs, making it challenging to distinguish between a common cold and COVID. The NHS states that the most prevalent COVID symptoms can include feeling fatigued, having a high temperature or chills, a new and persistent cough, alterations to or loss of sense of smell or taste, headache, body aches, shortness of breath, a sore throat, a runny or blocked nose, diarrhea, loss of appetite, and nausea or vomiting. If you exhibit COVID symptoms, the NHS recommends staying at home and avoiding contact with others. The guidance further suggests that you can resume work, school, or other regular activities once you've recovered. Children displaying mild symptoms like a runny nose, sore throat or light cough can continue to attend school or nursery if they're feeling well enough. Most individuals with symptoms don't need to take a COVID test. However, if you do and it returns positive, you should stay at home and avoid contact with others for 3 days after the test if you are under 18. Anyone aged 18 or above should remain indoors and steer clear of contact with other people for 5 days. The advice goes on to state, avoid meeting people who are more likely to get seriously ill from infections, such as people with a weakened immune system, for 10 days after the day you took your test.
A Christmas market and festival of Christmas will join the festive big wheel on Broadgate as part of this year's city's seasonal offering and an alternative to the Christmas light switch-on event. The big wheel opens on Saturday the 22nd of November, offering rides for both adults and children throughout the day and evening. Market stalls selling seasonal food, drinks and gifts will also be set up in Broadgate, bringing festive cheer to the heart of the city. On the same day, the city will also hold a one-off free family event, the Festival of Christmas, from 3 p.m. to 8 p.m. The event will see a magical trail of activities and entertainment taking place across various locations in the city centre. The Christmas lights will be switched on without fanfare on this date. The Festival of Christmas will include street theatre, live performances and dazzling displays, from magically illuminated processions to an appearance by Father Christmas. Councillor Abdul Salam Khan, Deputy Leader and Cabinet Member for Events, said, "Last year's Festival of Christmas event received a huge amount of positive feedback from those who attended. Everyone is invited. It really will bring festive magic to our city centre as we see breathtaking performances, comedy shows and traditional Christmas characters in different locations throughout the city centre." The council will also be offering free car parking for entry after 3 p.m. on the following dates in council city centre car parks. That's on Saturday the 22nd of November, Saturday the 20th of December, Monday the 22nd of December and Tuesday the 23rd of December. Councillor Patricia Heatherton said, "Our festive lights will be switched on for our Festival of Christmas event, but as well as Christmas, the lights are used for a number of occasions, including Remembrance Day and Diwali. For Diwali, lights will also be switched on along Fozil Road and Stony Stanton Road."
A petition calling for the government not to introduce digital ID cards has received more than 1.5 million signatures. Sir Keir Starmer announced last Friday that the government would introduce a new ID system by 2029 that would be mandatory for people working in the UK. The petition called on the government to commit to not introducing digital ID cards, saying, "We think this would be a step towards mass surveillance and digital control, and that no one should be forced to register with a state-controlled ID system." It received more than 6,800 signatures in an hour on Saturday morning, then reaching more than 1,564,000 entries. Petitions on the UK government which receive more than 100,000 signatures will be considered for a debate. Reform UK leader Nigel Farage criticised the planned scheme, calling it an anti-British card. Writing in the Daily Express, he said, "The Labour government's plan to impose digital ID cards on all adults will do nothing to combat illegal immigration, but it will give the state more power to control the British people." Ministers had previously said the ID would only be needed as proof someone has the right to work in the UK as part of a bid to cut illegal immigration. But Darren Jones, who is spearheading the policy as Chief Secretary to the Prime Minister, suggested digital ID could have much wider uses in future. He told the Global Progress Action Summit in London, "If we get this digital ID system working, and the public along with us, that will be the bedrock of the modern state, and will allow for really quite exciting public service reform in the future." Earlier, Sir Keir had told the same conference that digital ID would help convince voters the immigration system was fair, saying, decent, pragmatic, fair-minded people want us to tackle the issues that they see around them. People will not be required to carry the ID, which will be held on smartphones.
In a couple of weeks, parents will be able to get free bus rides to reduce the cost of keeping children busy during the October half term in Coventry. Parents and carers can apply for a pre-loaded Swift travel card with free bus travel between Monday, October the 27th and Sunday, November the 2nd, as part of the West Midlands ongoing campaign to encourage more people to use buses. Those who take up the free deal will then be offered a 25% discount on a further week's travel. The offer is part of a £20 million passenger incentive programme funded by the government through the Bus Service Improvement Plan. It follows the success of free evening bus travel in the run-up to last Christmas and a try-before-you-buy incentive scheme for key workers. Mayor of the West Midlands, Richard Parker, said, "At a time when family budgets are stretched, I'm delighted to offer a free half term on the buses. This will make it cheaper, easier and greener to take the kids out for the day, perhaps for Halloween or even a fireworks display. And while we do that, we're busy bringing our buses back under public control, improving services and creating a transport system that works better for everyone. The offer is available to all bus users travelling with a child. Applications will be available on the Transport for West Midlands website from next Monday, October the 6th.
Residents in a Coventry neighbourhood are being urged to stay vigilant after reports of door-to-door cold calling. Scammers have been reported operating in Holbrooks. Concerns have been raised that individuals posing as salespeople, charity workers or tradespeople are targeting unsuspecting households on Rotherham Road. Authorities are particularly concerned about vulnerable or elderly residents who are often primary targets and easily pressurised. Locals are being urged to take extra precautions when dealing with visitors who turn up unannounced. Safety tips include avoiding the sharing of personal or financial details and ensuring that anyone entering your home is verified by asking for ID. Anyone who witnesses suspicious behaviour or feels threatened by someone knocking at their door is encouraged to report it immediately via 101. Neighbourhood groups are also being asked to stay alert and share any relevant information on Facebook. A spokesman for Coventry Police said, "We have been made aware of possible door-to-door cold calling off Rotherham Road. Salespeople, charities, rogue traders and scammers often do this. If you are not expecting a visitor, please do not fully open your door. Use a door chain and speak through or use a window. Never share personal or financial information at the door. And above all, do not let them into your home. If you have been visited by a cold caller and they seem aggressive or suspicious, call 101 or, if you feel threatened, 999. Rogue traders and scammers can also be reported to Trading Standards via Citizens Advice and Action Fraud."
The multi-storey car park at Coventry's former IKEA building could be demolished. This is one of a raft of proposals that have emerged in a new planning application. The City Council unveiled plans to turn the well-known blue building into a cultural hub after the Swedish furniture giant shut its doors in 2020. It contracted ISG to carry out this work, but the firm went into administration. John Graham Construction was then appointed to take over. But this has led to some key planning changes to the design. In a new planning application, the company says there have been some major changes. These include knocking down the three-storey car park, which would be replaced with a surface car park, while space for future commercial and retail tenants would now be created at ground floor level. The new north elevation will be clad in matching aluminium cladding to the surrounding area. The vehicle conservation area, vehicle and store will be relocated to level 1, and there will be a new glazed entrance area. In an application that seeks the go-ahead for the new plans, it states, these changes were in response to future-proofing the ground floor of the building and providing more flexibility for potential tenants.
A former hotel and separate manor house in Coventry has been put on the market. The former Iliff Hotel in Tolbar End is on sale for £1,700,000. The hotel has 49 bedrooms, with the main house providing 17 guest rooms. The Iliff, formerly known as Chorus Chase Hotel, has been a Laura Ashley branded hotel since 2019 and offers daily afternoon tea services to guests. The property, listed with Savills as a bar, restaurants, meeting and event spaces, and 85 car parking spaces. The hotel is described as in need of modernisation and has potential for refurbishment and redevelopment subject to the requisite consents. The hotel closed in December 2021, as previously reported. Plans to convert it into a care home fell through due to current economic conditions. The hotel later gained a Grade 2 listed status. The listing affirms that there is potential to upgrade the existing buildings and improve value.
It's now officially autumn, so the weather is getting colder and the days are getting shorter. But some things are unchanged and roadworks continue. These vary from cycleway installations to footway improvements, drainage works, HS2 works and footway reconstructions. Roadworks that we have been advised about are Flecknoe Street, road closure from 7:30 a.m. till 4 p.m. until Friday, October the 10th for footway reconstruction. Robin Hood Road from Euston Crescent to Flecknoe Street, two-way lights from 7:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. until Friday, October the 10th for that footway reconstruction. Holyhead Road from Sherborne Crescent to number 451 until Friday, October the 17th for verge protection schemes. Holyhead Road from Grayswood Avenue to Dulverton Avenue until Friday, December the 12th for footway reconstruction. Catesby Road from Rollison Road to Burnaby Road, road closure from 7:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. until Friday, October the 31st for footway reconstruction. Clifford Bridge Road, Section 2, Tesco Roundabout B4082 to Brinklow Road Junction, 24-hour narrow lanes and temporary lights until April the 3rd, 2026 for the cycleway scheme. Humber Road, from the Asda Island to the Binley Road Island, 24-hour narrow lane and temporary lights until April the 3rd, 2026 for those cycleway schemes. And Holbrook Lane, two-way lights until Friday, October the 17th for drainage works. And there's always the possibility of emergency work, so please take care whenever you are out.
Outlook News.
So that completes a roundup of local news from Anne and Peter. Thank you. And now, of course, we're going to move on to Hugh to find out what's happening here at the Hub and what will be happening here at the Hub.
Thank you, Nigel. What will be happening here at the Hub on the 9th of October is our open day, of course. We've been banging on around this for a bit, but there's going to be lots of interesting stuff going on, including demonstration of Showdown. So if you've not seen Showdown yet, absolutely come and have a go, take part. I think it'd be a really good thing to do.
What are you doing at Boston Lodge?
No, that's going to happen in the Mary Beale room back there. Yeah. They like it in there because the sound's a bit deader. So the ball with the sounder in is a bit easier to identify where it is. But we're going to have people demonstrating using the IT and devices and things. We've got Craft Group and Braille Group demonstrating, and the allotment people will be in the garden. But we've also got a number of other organisations coming to take part. So we've got, we don't have the people themselves, but we've got a whole bunch of products from Cobalt. Cobalt do a number of products for visually impaired people. Some are great, some less so, but they're going to be sending us a whole bunch of stuff that will be demonstrated for that. We're going to have Humanware here. They do some electronic magnifiers and various other bits of equipment. Citizen Housing are going to be here, so that's going to be quite important. If you're a tenant of Citizen, it's good to come and just have a chat with them so that they make sure, because if you're visually impaired, you know, you have certain special needs, and they've got a team of people who are absolutely right up there to help you achieve the things you want to achieve. You know, sometimes
things for them, will they? Yes, rails and things.
Yeah. I mean, yes, presumably
anything necessary.
But but they'll help you manage all those sorts of things. The visual and hearing impairment team will be here. Of course, we know them very well. Now, bowel screening. Now, when you get to a certain age, you get a little thing that comes through your door. Pooper scoopers. You have to test your poo. Now, what the hospital has been finding out is that visually impaired people in particular, and for pretty obvious reasons, are not taking up the bowel screening as much as they ought to. So they've been developing some different things. Anyway, they're going to come here and talk. So they're going to have a table here in order to be able to reach people with visual impairments and basically tell them how to do
it. No physical instructions, though.
No physical instructions, exactly. So, but it's really important to take part in the bowel screening. You reach 55, I think it is.
And they stop again, about 75, I think.
Yes.
They stop with me, that's for sure.
Really, okay.
Early
indicator for bowel cancer, and if the earlier they get it, the much better it is, because if you get it late, then it's not a good scene.
You actually don't know when you've got it very often.
No,
you
don't, exactly. Yeah, so they do the testing. Really, so absolutely, everybody needs to get involved in that. So we've got people coming to talk a bit more about that. We've got Diabetes UK coming as well, so that'll be quite good. We're hoping that we might get Associated Optical coming along. And, of course, the big ticket item is we have Boots coming along to demonstrate the Meta Ray-Ban glasses. So these are the glasses that basically tell you what's going on in the world around you. Definitely worth having a look at. These are the version ones, actually. There's a whole bunch of other new versions coming out in next year as well. Last week I was at, which is why you had the pleasure of Chris's company rather than mine, I was at the Visionary Conference in Birmingham, and there were lots of people wearing Meta Ray-Ban glasses around, and they really, really appreciated
it. This is this year's technology, isn't it?
Yes.
It's very new technology.
Very new technology, and they're a bit of a game changer, really. And the good thing is that Meta, which is basically Facebook and Instagram, and Ray-Ban, who work together to make these glasses, they're building in accessibility and features for visually impaired people right from the get-go. I mean, they're not designed specifically for visually impaired people, but actually visually impaired people saying, oh my god, these are great, game changer. A game changer within certain limits, it can make a big difference to people. So it's definitely worth coming and having a look.
Any idea what the cost is going to be?
The costs are about £350. So, I mean, they're not super expensive.
No.
I mean, if you think about the Orcam, which is,
A pair of glasses,
Yes, exactly. But, Orcam, which is a digital thing, that's £4,000 or something. It's pricey. Mm. Any of that sort of stuff. So, these are affordable. So come and have a look at those.
They'll be available from Boots, through here. Obviously, but Boots are going to stop.
Boots and various other places have them, but the Boots have decided, I think it's the Boots in Charlesmore, actually, they're the ones who are coming to demonstrate the ones that they have. So So that's that. Right. Those of you who've ordered poppies from Julia Springhiren, please do let us have her money. So it's £1.50, and we will so we'll take that in and put it in a pot in reception, so that we can give it to Julia for and she's going to be putting up towards the Royal British Legion. We've got fitness class, of course, that started a few weeks ago. There's still a little bit of space on there. The people who do it love it, and it's hard work and it's good, you know, and it's really proper exercise. There are some like little parameters on this, like that you've got to be able to get down on the floor and get back up again three times in a minute, and be able to walk walk for half an hour unaided. I mean, by which I mean if you need a guide, that's one thing, but you know, without having to use a walker or a walking stick or whatever. So so that's the minimum requirements for that, but if you're interested in that, there's still a few spaces on that, in that group.
What when does it happen?
It happens on Wednesday mornings, right. At about 12. Yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, that makes technically Wednesday afternoon.
Yes. But yeah, so technically
before speaking, lunch. Before lunch. Yes, exactly. Definitely do it before lunch rather than after. Yes. Now, a couple of weeks ago, I was telling you a bit about some issues to do with the Community Eye Care Service. So this is the system whereby opticians are like the GPs for the eyes. And if you've got something wrong with your eyes, you notice a sudden change in vision or whatever, then you go to your local optician. The optician would have a look, and then if necessary, refer you straight up to the hospital if it's really, really urgent. They might help you with treatment or, you know, take you through other paths. But anyway, they're basically a triage service for eye care. Now, the Integrated Care Board, which basically doles out all the money for NHS services, have decided that they don't want to pay for this programme as it's currently constituted from the end of October. And they're looking to close it, basically be closed for 5 months at least, while they recommission something else. The problem is that if people aren't being seen in their opticians, the GP certainly can't do it, the pharmacist certainly can't do it, everybody is going to end up at the hospital, and there's not enough room or time or people up at the hospital, so it's going to have it's going to have a really big impact on sight loss people with sight loss, you know, who are going up for regular treatment and all those sorts of things up at the hospital. Big impact on waiting lists and, of course, waiting times, the amount of time you're just sat in the eye clinic, which is depressing enough. So so I'm working quite hard with a bunch of people to try and persuade the ICB to change their mind, at least to, you know, retain the current situation until April, until they've managed to recommission.
So they are actually going to do something else again later.
Theoretically.
It's not going completely as far as we hope. Yeah.
Well, it is 5 months, according to current, which is...
But then it should come back.
Should.
Yes.
Theoretically, yeah. Though we don't know. I mean, they haven't made any particular decisions yet. So it's, you know, it's not a wise move. I mean, they're basically... It would save them a lot of money because they don't have to pay the community opticians, and the hospital doesn't get any extra money for seeing more people. But it does create this really big vacuum, problem. Yeah. So we might be getting into the press, maybe TV, about this in the next week or so. But... you know, our aim is absolutely to get the ICB to change their minds and to allow the current situation to continue, because otherwise it's all going to be a bit of a snarl up, and you know, and the real risk is that people who've got you know, who've got sight loss conditions that need immediate treatment are not going to get the immediate treatment, and that would be
just makes it far worse, far quicker.
Far worse, far quicker. Yeah. So anyway, so keep your ears peeled for that. If you peel your ears, I don't know. Brookshaw or whatever his name was on Police 5. Do you remember him? Keep them peeled.
Show your age now.
I know. Keep your eyes peeled.
Yes, that's right.
And anyway, but keep your ears peeled for that.
Yes.
Anyway, so that is it for that. Of course, now we've had the equinox, of course. And so it's a little darker in the evenings. The clocks don't go back for another 3 weeks or so.
It's last weekend of October.
When they do, if you need your watches changing, you know where to come, and I will give you that reminder again, perhaps in a couple of weeks.
And then there's the theatre visit.
Yes, the theatre. Well, yes, we've got the theatre, but I think we've got enough people for the theatre now.
Oh, have you? Good.
Yes, so if you've not signed up to the theatre, you're too late.
Yeah. Because when is it going to be?
Oh, gosh, now you're saying it's a Friday.
It's a week on... If anyone falls out next week, then give them a quick reminder.
Possibly, yes. It's a week on, I think it's a week on Friday. Yes, we're full. I think it's a week on Friday, or it might be two weeks on Friday. I can't remember.
Yeah. Okay. Excellent. Thank you, Hugh.
Thank you.
See you. And now it's time for Sarah. Sarah's here with her full sports report, inevitably after women's resounding rugby success.
Well, hello there, lovely, lovely, lovely listeners. You get an extra lovely this week because I'm rather happy. Now, I got up on Saturday and I could see these three ducks all in line. And I thought, they're my three sporting ducks and they're all waiting to fall or come home to roost or ducklings to hatch, whichever simile you wish to use. It's all right, folks, I'm totally quackers. Now, my first duck was on Saturday in the shape of Coventry City versus Birmingham City. And I apologise here to my lovely Blues fan who I met at the summer party. You know what's coming, though. Now, before the match started, there'd been a lot of speculation and worry because Jack Redoni, our star, wasn't in the squad. And there was a lot of talk about, oh, his shoulder must have dislocated again, he's going to have surgery. But actually, as we found out at the end, it is an injury, but it's a calf strain. So just a couple of weeks, hopefully. But I need to worry, nor need the commentators about Jack not being in the squad. 15 minutes after the start, a superb cross to BTA, otherwise known as Brandon Thomas Asante, and he scored. And then we carried on, and I have to say, as did the commentators, and I'm very much guided by them, the ref was very one-sided. Birmingham were getting away with things that Coventry weren't. But, nevertheless, in the 44th minute, Birmingham had a player sent off for picking up his second yellow card. So at half-time, it was Coventry 1, Birmingham 0, and Coventry with an extra man on the pitch. 10 minutes into a superb second half. Goal! Now, at first, we all thought this had been scored by Josh Eccles, who was returning to the Coventry squad after a long layoff with injury, but it was given as an own goal. And it was actually despite the best attempts of their goalie to shovel it out of the goal mouth and say, "But it hasn't crossed the line, sir." But it had. And then shortly before the end, a superb cross again to Ellis Sims, who rammed it towards the goal. But unfortunately, the goalkeeper was able to pad it out. But who was waiting? Victor Torpedo Torp, who scored again. And that is how it finished. Coventry 3, Birmingham 0. So midweek we're away at Millwall, and I'll talk about that next week. And then next Saturday we're away again to Sheffield Wednesday at Hillsborough. And that, for those of you who want to listen to it, is also a 12:30 kickoff. So that was one of my ducks had come home to mama. What about the other two? So for my second duck, we head to Twickenham, or the Alliance Stadium, as I believe it's now called, or currently called, where England were taking on Canada in the final of the Rugby Union World Cup. Now, I wasn't actually that nervous about this one. I mean, England had won 33 matches on the trot. This would be their 34th. Well, I say I wasn't nervous. That was until the commentator said, well, of course, Canada are second in the world, although England are top. Well, it was made worse when soon after the start, Canada scored a try. But like France last week, they could not convert it. So that's how it was. England 0, Canada 5. Until that Ellie Kildon woman picked the ball up and ran like the proverbial bat out of heck and scored a lovely try just between the posts. Fairly easy to convert. 7-5. And soon after that, we went and did it again. Although this time it was a bit of what I call a messy affair. You know what I mean in rugby union. A lot of pushing, shoving, grunting, until somebody just grabbed that ball and scored. England 14, Canada 5. Well, I think at this point I began to doze. Anyway, England scored again and converted it, and we allowed Canada a kick, so that at half time it was 21-8. Well, we let them score once more, but again they couldn't convert. But then to pile on their agony, we scored two more tries, though only converted one. So the final score was England 33 and world champions, Canada 13. Two things to say about this. The attendance was over 81,800, which is phenomenal. And it's the second greatest ever attendance for a Rugby World Cup final, be it men or women. And secondly, as a friend pointed out, it was a bit, well, disappointing, I think is the polite word, that Canada's Prime Minister, Mark Carney, had flown over to be at the match and support his women. Who was there from England's? No one. Well, it was. There were a few lionesses, but no royals and no politicians. And so what about my third duck? Would that also come home? Well, I was most nervous about my third duck. Golf, but not just any golf. Oh no, it was the Ryder Cup. Now, the Ryder Cup, for those of you who don't know, is played between 12 golfers representing Europe and 12 golfers representing the USA. And shall we say it brings out the best and the worst in the crowd. I mean, to give you a taste of it, there was one attendee dressed as the Statue of Liberty, whilst another dressed apparently as a chicken nugget. Well, says all you can really, doesn't it? So, the format is also identical every Ryder Cup. That is, on the first and second day, the Friday and Saturday, the players play as four players, two for each team. But in the morning, there are just two balls, meaning that, for instance, the Europeans, European 1 will hit first, then European 2 hit second, then 1, then 2, etc. Whereas in the afternoon, they're the more traditional four balls, where each player has their own ball, and the winner overall of each hole gets the points for either Europe or the States. Now, traditionally, Europe have done better in the pairs and the foursomes than they do in the singles. It just seems to be that the American players are better playing on their own. Oh, well. So how did it start? Well, by the end of the first morning, Europe were leading 3-1. And then President Trump arrived. I have to say, this was almost calamity, because he was wearing his golf shoes. I don't know if he thought he was going to be invited to play, but he was literally sat in what appeared to be, from descriptions, a solid bulletproof glass cube, carefully positioned on the first hole. Well, whatever floats your boat. Anyway, it didn't have the real desired effect, because by the end of the Friday, it was Europe 5.5, United States 3.5. Saturday came and went, and it was very much more of the same. Europe 8.5, America 3.5 after the first session. And then Saturday ended, Europe 11.5, United States 4.5. So that was 2 days gone, just the singles to come. Remember I said that the USA always do much better in the singles than we did. Now that 11.5, 4.5 became 12-5 by the beginning of play on the Sunday, because there's this quaint rule in the Ryder Cup. It's called the envelope rule. And before the tournament, each player puts in an envelope the name of one player from their team. They will withdraw if the opposing team has one player who has to withdraw through injury. Well, we did, and so the American envelope was applied, both sides getting 0.5. Now, this was a genuine injury, I have no doubt about that, because the Danish player had to withdraw from his match on Saturday and to be replaced at the very last moment. So that was how it began. So we basically needed to get to 14 points, either side did, 14 points to retain it, although only actually Europe could retain as the existing holders. For the USA it would mean draw it, or 4.5 for a winner. Surely we could do that. Well, it wasn't really that easy, and it was such a stressful evening to sit down in front of the television. The television has a colour scheme in that when the USA are one up on a hole, the hole turns red, and when Europe are, the hole turns blue, or a sort of weird grey colour means that it's all square at that time. So it began, as I said, 12-5, but then it became 12-6, and before long it was 12-7, followed by 12-8. But then, Ludwig Åberg, one of our European players, won his hole, and it became 13-8. Surely, guys, there's still quite a few of you out on the course. One of you can bring it home. Well, one of them did, followed by our last player to score at that time, Shane Lowry of Ireland, who putted home to make it 14 points to Europe. There was absolute scenes of wild jubilation amongst the European supporters and of exit amongst the United States supporters. Now, given that play had started at 5 p.m., it didn't that point when Shane delivered us the Ryder Cup didn't actually happen until 10:15. So it was quite a long session. But we did manage to get the extra half point. Well, actually, we got 2 half points. And it was so lovely to see the Scottish player who delivered the final blow, making it 14.5. Triumphantly welcomed as he walked up the final green with supporters singing the Scottish anthem, Scotland the Brave. So, we retained the Ryder Cup. So what is this Ryder Cup that everybody's going frantic about? Well, in basic terms, it's 17.5 inches high. It weighs £4 in weight and it was made in Sheffield. And I am a very happy bunny to introduce another animal because all my ducklings have hatched and my ducks fell into place and came home to mama. And finally, I've got a quick question to you. Who's going to win Team of the Year and Sports Personality of the Year? Will it be our English women winning the Football Europas? Or will it be our English women winning the Rugby World Cup? Or will it be European team winning the Ryder Cup? The choice is ours, but I can't wait. And that has been all of your rather quackers sport for this week. Bye.
Congratulations to our women's team. They're a bit like buses, aren't they? You wait for one for ages and then two come along at the same time. But now it's over to Dave with your messages in his postbag this week.
This is Postbag. Join in the discussion.
Hello there and welcome to your postbag. We begin with an endorsement from Bob Syme of Mark the Gardener, recommended to Jag Singh by Doreen Hilton.
Hello, this is Bob Syme. Just about Mark as your gardener. Mark Upton is like a family friend of mine. He's my cousin's cousin and I can highly recommend Mark to look after your gardens for you. I did mention it about 2 years ago on the tape that Mark would do your gardens for you. Take good care of yourselves, all of you, but Mark will definitely look after you. Bob Syme, goodbye.
Thank you, Bob. Mark the gardener once again is on 07909713685. And now is Jag Singh again to talk about help given at the Wave Swimming Bath.
Hi everybody, this is Jag Singh, hope you're all keeping well. Just thought I'd share something very interesting with everybody out there. There's the Wave in Coventry, they offer a fantastic service called Welcome Me. You can book, so if you've got a disability, you could book somebody to meet you at the door and help guide you or help you to the swimming pool or to any of the facilities, and they'll help guide you out as well. It helps you maintain your independence as well as getting out and about and getting out of the house and working on your health and fitness. So it's called Welcome Me. It's available at the Wave in Coventry City Centre. It may be available at other places as well, but I definitely know it's available at the Wave. And it's just something good for everybody who has a challenge but just needs a little bit of help. Also, on a personal note, I'd like to thank Doreen Hilton for giving me the contact details on Mark the Gardener. I'm meeting him next week. But it's great when we all share and we all care. So thank you, Doreen, and I hope that helps with anybody who wants to go out to the Wave you just use a facility called Welcome Me. Take care, everybody.
Thank you very much, Jack. Downstairs, they have the 25-metre lanes, and upstairs, they have the chutes for the more adventurous. Thank you, Jack, for some more helpful information. So if you want to go swimming, there is help available at the Wave. And just recently, Graham talked about his favourite smells and sound, which was the sounds of the waves crashing on the beach. Graham compares the sound quality of the recording he did for that recording on cassette tape with the quality of the postbag phone messages now, and the and also he goes on to talk about the distinctive sound of Bob Dylan.
It was interesting to hear my piece about smells and sound this week. It just shows the difference between the quality of that and the quality of my recordings now through the Hub's telephone system, which I feel ought to be a little better than it is. I do think it's a good scoop for Coventry, a big scoop, having Bob Dylan coming to perform in Coventry. I think it ought to be a good night if you fancied going. He's a prolific writer, of course, but I think he's a better writer than he is a performer, as is also Leonard Cohen. And I think in both cases I prefer the cover versions of their material rather than the original. Nevertheless, he has a vast repertoire to choose from, and it promises to be a long night, I think, if anybody went along to it. But yeah, it could certainly be a good concert, I should think.
Thank you, Graham. There was a film made about Bob Dylan's life just recently. It was very good. And do you think Bob Dylan's songs sound better sung by other artists? Let us know. Sheila and I once went to a little church in Penryn Bay in Llandudno with our friends Elaine and Doug, and we listened to George Hamilton IV, an American country and western singer who used to be on the radio on a program called Country Meets Folk. During his talk or sermon, he gave a great impersonation of the speaking voice of Bob Dylan, having known him personally. Talking about cassette tapes, that Graham recorded his favourite sounds and smells on, former blind Home Secretary David Blunkett once sent a message into Postbag to the late Fred Weed, and he also spoke in praise of cassette tapes.
Discerning listeners might actually realise that I'm recording this on an old-fashioned cassette. I still use the old-fashioned cassettes rather than the digital or the small discs, because you can move the tape to and fro more easily. You can repeat or eliminate or mess about with what you've recorded, and it's much handier for me. But I'm a bit of a Luddite when it comes to technology. I have a computer with a synthetic voice and the necessary software, but it drives me absolutely bonkers, and I've got soon to get on top of all this and to be much more proficient. Anyway, this was just a short insert to say a very big thanks to all those, David and his colleagues, who are operating the equipment, choosing the material, reading onto tape, and of course the administration of getting it out. A big thank you to all of them. And a big thank you to you for listening, and to wish you well for the rest of this year and beyond. So this is David Blunkett signing off with very good wishes and congratulations to everyone involved.
Hearing is also important to Doreen Hilton, who talks about her favourite sounds.
As for hearing, I do have a little amount of hearing loss, and it's very hard to pick up, which anybody that's like us, you know, wearing hearing aids or can't hear at all, I would say, you know, it's a very complicated thing. But as for me, like, I will give on the earring side of it. I like listening to the wind and the wind chime, which I have got on my patio on the backyard. And I think a wind chime in with the wind, it's a beautiful sound. And you can sit there, you know, and sort of dream away with it, but not too much. So, Edwina, I do hope that you will be able to get my, what I was saying about it. It's very good subject, what you gave. And all the other things that you do and come across with as well, some of them have been lovely, and I've actually tried some of them. So there we go, Edwina. Thank you very much for what you did. So this is Doreen Hilton Hall signing off. Bye, till the next time. Bye all.
Thank you, Doreen. So what are your favourite sounds? Let us know in Postbag. If you like the sound of people talking, especially with you, and who doesn't? Robert Franklin has helpfully sent in the phone number of R&IB Talk and Support, where you get together for a group chat, I think once a week, which is really wonderful, so give it a go. R&IB Talk and Support is on 0303 123 9999. So there's no need to feel isolated when there's so much outlets available for communication, including, of course, Coventry Vision Hub and Postbag. So thank you for your messages this week. So give us a call on that number, 02476 717522, and press 5 for Coventry Talking Newspaper, or write a letter, or any way you feel happiest. Thank you very much, but please let's hear from you next time. Bye for now.
This is Outlook. You can contact Postbag.
Our website is www.talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Our email address is postbag@talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Join in the discussion on Postbag.
So that's this week's Postbag, and don't forget, Dave would love to hear from you, and as he says, it's very easy to do it. Now, from wartime memories at Napton last week, Elaine moves to the first of the Newbolds, Newbold on Avon.
In step with other villages, people and places in Newbold have changed dramatically over the years. Main Street now boasts a Balti restaurant and a fish and chip shop, a beauty salon, a television and video repair shop, and a car sales room, as well as the mini supermarket and post office, and a butcher's. The Clark brothers retired, and their mother, at over 100 years old, decided to stop working in the shop, the butcher's shop. The village hall, an old school built in the mid-1800s, is flourishing and well used. And the two schools are expanding to include a nursery class. Newbold Rugger Club has a certain standing in the Midlands, especially with the tradition and proximity of Rugby School, where it all started. St. Botolph's Church stands just below the summit of a hill overlooking the village. It was built in the 19th century on the site of an earlier church. To the right of the chancel arch can be seen part of the early 14th century tiled floor of the previous church. An incised slab under the arch in the south wall is to Thomas and Elizabeth Boughton and is dated 1454. It may be that this arch tomb indicates that they were responsible for the rebuilding of the church at that time. The organ is dated about 1800 and is believed to have come from Rugby School Chapel in 1858. The tower contains 8 bells. The clock, dated 1795, is by Sam Dalton of Rugby, and the weather vane, designed in 1975, represents St. Botolph, the patron saint of travellers, with his pack donkey, or the original patron saint of travellers with his pack donkey. Diagonally across the churchyard can be seen the sunken line of the old arm of the Oxford Canal, which served brickworks and quarries between Newbold and Rugby. This was closed in 1840, but one end of the tunnel can be seen from the field behind the tower. The Oxford Canal flows past the village through one of the longest tunnels in the area, roughly a quarter of a mile. Years ago, the canal was used to carry coal by horse and barge all over the Midlands. Now it is used for leisure, with motorised barges and boats, which brings a lot of visitors to the village and has increased business to the local shops. At one time, the top half of the village was closed off by a gate across the road, and now on one corner is one of the three public houses, which have all been improved and enlarged. Several small enclaves of new housing have been built, and a bridge, opened by the then mayor in December 1971, has alleviated flooding problems and helps to unite the two parts of the village. The skyline is dominated by the massive works at Rugby Cement, visible from all parts of the village. The old quarry has now become Newbold Quarry Park, and extensive works have made it into a beauty spot, well used by anglers, walkers and dog walkers.
And another Newbold next week, Newbold on Stour. Last week there was a cheesemonger's tour of France, and this week Margaret's article by Ned Palmer in the Daily Express talks about the English cheesemakers, many of which have been taken over by bigger concerns.
France is still home to many wonderful traditional cheese and cheesemakers, as I found out when I went to visit them recently while working on my new book, A Cheesemonger's Tour de France. But they are clearly feeling the pressures of modernity which threatened British traditions some time ago. In Aveyron in southern France, Delphine Carr made Roquefort like her grandfather did. This spicy blue sheep's milk cheese has the most specific terroir of all. To take that hallowed name, it must be matured in a warren of caves under the little village of Roquefort-sur-Soulon, which straggles the edge of limestone plateau Mont Combalou. Visiting the caves is a magical experience. You step further back into the past, the deeper you go into them. At the very bottom, surrounded by cobwebbed rocky walls, the young cheeses sit on massive oak shelves blackened with age and made shiny with the rich fat of the sheep's milk. Here you notice great black domed loaves of bread sitting alongside them. The blue mould for Delphine's cheeses grows in these loaves, a unique strain which has evolved in her family's caves. When it's ready, the loaves are crumbled up and that powdery blue mould is added to the milk. It is an ancient practice. In modern dairies, the mould is brought in and comes in sachets of freeze-dried powder. Delphine is one of the few makers who use the traditional method. Most of the other individual makers have been subsumed into larger concerns owned by international dairy giants Lactalis and Savencia, victims of the modern trend towards consolidation. Every spring, way down south in the Pyrenees, Stefan Cetri takes his sheep up to the highest pastures near the border with Spain, where he will spend the whole belle saison making osso irati with their milk, coming back down to the valley in October. Stefan grew up in these high pastures while his mother and father tended their animals and made cheese, as the people of that region, both Basque and Béarnais, have for thousands of years. Stefan says the milk from the high pastures gives a delicate floral note. Cheeses made in the valley in the autumn are more sheepy. The AOC for Ossau Irati, set up in 1980, allows for large-scale production as much as traditional, and hitherto made little distinction between the two. Industrial cheeses are as valorized as those of the valley and the high pasture. This makes it hard for consumers to distinguish between the traditional and the modern. a source of constant frustration for Stefan, who is passionate about keeping traditional farming practices alive. On the banks of the River Loire, near the town of Sancerre, Emmanuel and Marguerite Mullet make the tiny goat's cheese, Crottin de Chavignon. Young cheeses are white and fluffy, with a moussey texture, fully aged. They are dark and firm, with a spicy animal flavour. Emmanuel and Marguerite are from local farming stock and have been making cheese since the 1970s. Recently, though, after decades of backbreaking, if rewarding, work, they've decided to retire, and their children, with jobs of their own and only too aware just how hard cheesemaking is, are not taking up the torch. If the Mullet can't find a buyer for their business, their distinctive Crottin will disappear. Can France's reputation for cheesemaking survive the pressures of consolidation, legislation and modern life and the rise of supermarkets? Though France still appears to love its cheese, I met many French people who had no interest in the cheeses of the region and greeted news of their decline with a Gallic shrug. When our industry was in decline, British cheesemakers went to the continent for help. Perhaps now British makers and mongers can return the favour by providing a model of how marrying a love of tradition with renewed enthusiasm and innovation can create new traditions, while encouraging customers to venture out of the supermarket and back to the fromagerie. In Brittany, which never had a cheesemaking tradition, a sort of naissance is in full flood, possibly inspired by Britons, with new cheesemakers popping up all over the region, usually people with no tradition of farming or dairying. And trammelled by tradition, the new wave Briton cheesemakers look to the rest of France for their inspiration, and a collection of Tom Osso-styled little goats and even a couple of cheddars are produced on the lush, salty pastures of the Arthurian land. They're sold by young and enthusiastic cheesemongers, often city dwellers, who, like the leaders of the British cheese renaissance, see something both exciting and valuable in the life led close to the land and the craft of making and selling cheese. I hope the cheesemakers and mongers of France and Britain continue to learn from each other. I hope the French embrace innovation with more vigour, and the British continue to treasure the jewels of an ancient cheese culture, and then we cheese lovers get to enjoy the fruits of this cheesy entente cordiale.
Well, tell us about your favourite English cheeses in Postbag. Pete wrote a whole series of fascinating articles about unusual local events, most of which happened many years ago, for the Coventry Telegraph when he worked there. And here's his story about peace celebrations ending in a street war.
It was meant to be the day that Coventry celebrated the return to peace after the horrors of the Great War, but it lit a fuse which brought the city to the brink of chaos. Saturday, July the 19th, 1919, began under sunny skies with children's processions, cheering crowds, and a peace pageant featuring Lady Godiva. It ended with stone-throwing crowds looting shops and battling with police in lashing rain, the opening skirmishes of 3 nights of bloody rioting. Over that weekend, Coventry edged close to anarchy as vicious street fighting left 100 people injured and dozens of shops smashed and looted. Only the arrival of massive police reinforcements from Birmingham and soldiers from the Wiltshire Regiment, drafted in from their billets at Radford Aerodrome, finally restored order. The Coventry peace riots were not the only example of serious unrest that troubled summer. In Liverpool, a bitter police strike was broken up by troops. In Yorkshire, striking miners brought the coalfield to a halt. And at Luton, an angry mob burned the town hall to the ground. But they remain the worst disturbances in the city's modern history, blamed at the time on criminal elements, but in reality stemming from much deeper feelings of resentment and discontent. The first targets were supposedly German-owned businesses like the King's Head Hotel and the Black Cat Cafe in Broadgate, both of which were attacked in the hours after the police celebrations ended. Too late, the owner of the Black Cat announced publicly that he was Danish, not German, and had strongly supported Britain in the late war. From his cafe, the crowds went on the rampage through Broadgate, destroying and looting 19 shops. A police baton charge scattered a mob smashing glass plate windows in Hertford Street, and the night ended with 24 people treated in hospital for injuries, three of them policemen. Hopes that the trouble was merely an isolated spasm of anti-German prejudice were dashed when crowds began gathering in Broadgate the following evening. Police attempts to move them on were met with a hail of bottles, stones and bricks. As the battle raged through surrounding streets, there were reports of women joining in, collecting in their aprons granite sets from a building site in Market Street to use as ammunition. A shopkeeper who had lost his son in the war was one of many who had his business wrecked that night as the rioters attacked boot and clothes shops, pubs, even co-op stores. Monday morning dawned on a city centre full of barricaded shops and littered with broken glass and discarded missiles. Despite a clear warning from the police that they would regard anybody on the streets as hostile, battle recommenced that evening after the pubs had shut. Fighting spread to Bishop Street and Hale Street as police went on the offensive, batons drawn against crowds of stone throwers. At one point, patrolling Red Cross squads found a dozen men lying injured in Market Street and another 10 in Bishop Street, including an elderly man with broken ribs. With 40 more people carted off to hospital, the rioting seemed to have burned itself out at last, and a mayoral proclamation threatening even more draconian measures proved unnecessary. At first, the rioting was blamed on a handful of hooligans. But it wasn't long before the truth emerged, with reports that many stone throwers were wearing the khaki uniforms of discharged soldiers. The Coventry branch of the National Federation of Discharged Soldiers and Sailors was quick to dissociate itself from the violence, but it also pointedly boycotted the peace celebrations, describing them as a farce at a time when the grievances of its members were not being addressed. It was widely believed that the festivities had been monopolised by those who'd done well out of the war, while its real heroes faced a chronic housing shortage, poor disablement pensions, and little prospect of work in booming factories which had filled their jobs while they were away at the front. Some were already homeless and living on the streets. Their bitterness was an explosion in search of a spark.
And there'll be more interesting stories of Coventry's history in future outlooks. Talking about Coventry, Elaine's now going to tell you about five interesting facts about the city you probably don't know. This is written by Danny Thompson, again in the Coventry Telegraph.
Coventry is an ancient city that can be dated back to at least the Anglo-Saxon period. As with any place with over 1,000 years of history, we're likely collectively forgotten more facts than we can remember. And often when it comes to interesting facts, the same ones get regurgitated. So we've tried our hardest to find some little-known shreds of knowledge about our city that we think the average Coventrian will not know. Fact number one. The Lanchester-Hollywood connection. Lanchester is a family name heavily connected to the city's engineering, manufacturing and educational institutions, thanks to Frederick W. Lanchester. He was one of 8 siblings, 2 of whom were involved alongside him in the city's motor industry. A sister, Edith Lanchester, was a suffragette, whose daughter was Hollywood siren Elsa Lanchester. You might not recognise the name, but she starred in some of the most iconic films of the 20th century, in a highly respected film career spanning decades. Her most famous roles include the titular bride opposite Boris Karloff in 1935 horror Bride of Frankenstein, and the stern and disgruntled Katie Nanna in Mary Poppins. Fact number two. Why is it called Wykin Slough when it's not in Wykin? It is the largest body of water in Coventry, set among stunning nature, and connects Woodend to Alderman's Green, but it's not actually in Wykeham. So why the name? Coventry in Warwickshire once had a thriving coal mining industry, with collieries in several areas, including Wykeham. When mines are dug, huge pipes are often used to allow the miners to tunnel beneath the earth. This often leads to a subsidence, a dip in the earth. In this instance, the Wykeham Colliery was built in the 1800s, on the edge of what is now the Woodend side of the reserve. This led to a large subsidence, forming a sizeable dip in the earth which filled with water, and became known as the Wykeham Slough, or Wykeham Pool, taking its name from the colliery that led to its formation. With industrialisation, Coventry's population boomed, and new housing estates popped up, leading to boundaries shifting, meaning where the colliery was located was likely at the time classed as Wykeham, even though now we'd consider it Woodend. Older Coventrians will remember the Slough as a much more vibrant place than it is today. In the 1950s, 60s and 70s, it was used as a city destination with boats and kiosks, where youngsters could hang out with pals and listen to their transistor radios after a day on the water. Interesting side note. Rumour has it the pool was used to dump debris during the clean-up operation from the Blitz. Fact number 3. Paul McCartney fined for speeding on the Fletchamstead Highway. Perhaps one of the most famous musicians this country ever produced was done for speeding here in Coventry, at the height of his Beatles career. McCartney was fined during a flying visit through the city after he was spotted speeding on Fletchamstead Highway. On Friday, February the 7th, 1969, a front page headline from the Coventry Evening Telegraph stated, "Beatle fined £15 for car offences." Officers had pulled him over while he was driving his Aston Martin DB6 car through the city the previous July. Apparently he'd been doing nearly 60 miles per hour in a 40 mile per hour zone. He is said to have told officers, "It's a fair cop. I thought I was doing just over 40. He was also fined for not having a road fund licence for the vehicle, as it had expired a few months earlier. Fact number 4. Bomb shelters. City parks and green spaces were used as underground communal bomb shelters during World War II. These trench shelters were dug out and could accommodate hundreds of people. Two of them, on Barras Heath and Gosford Green, could hold over 1,000, according to a Coventry Evening Telegraph report from March 1940. One of the best-known spots was the middle island of Radford's Jubilee Crescent, which was once an underground bomb shelter that could hold 306 people. Whitley Common was also used, as were dozens of other sites around the city. These shelters were advertised before the worst of the bombing started. Sadly, one of the above-mentioned sites, Gosford Green, suffered a direct hit when the bombing began, and 90 people died. Fact number 5. A forgotten sports stadium. There was once a much-loved stadium located within the shadow of Coventry's current most popular sports venue, the CBS Arena. The Lythalls Lane Stadium, also known as the Foles Hill Stadium, or simply Coventry Stadium, held dog racing and speedway events, attracting thousands of visitors a night for over 40 years, up until the 1960s. The ground has a fascinating and sad history, including a general manager who took his own life in his office at the stadium, a fire which destroyed the main stand in 1933, and a clubhouse destroyed during the Blitz. It was demolished in 1964, the only trace of it being reflected in a small street named Stadium Close.
So did you know about those things? Now Margaret reads more of Susie Dent's Origin of Words and Phrases, taken from the Radio Times.
Phrase of the Week, OMG. The age of the words we assume to be very modern can often surprise. The abbreviation OMG for simple, it dates back at least 100 years when it was used in a message to Winston Churchill from the Admiral of the Fleet. In a letter penned in 1917, John Arbuthnot Fisher wrote, "I hear that a new order of knighthood is on the carpet. Oh my God, OMG. Shower it on the Admiralty." LOL is similarly first recorded a good 3 decades before its popularity exploded during the 1990s, even if the police of San Francisco decided to use it as an acronym for the phrase little old lady. What we now know today as tech speak is in fact nothing new. The British Library holds a love poem that shows a pithy language was alive and well even in the 19th century. Tamaluz. There comes a time when greetings like how are you or what are you up to no longer cut the mustard. In France, this is when pensioners join a club whose members have been dubbed the Tamaluz. They are of an age when the hottest news involves not work, family or holidays, but rather doctor's appointments and the speaker's latest aches and pains. Tamalu is a mangling of the question ta mal u, or where does it hurt? In Italy, a name has been created for older men who gather at building sites and idly pass the time commenting on what's going on or offering unsolicited advice to the builders. They go by the name of Umaril, or Little Men. Closer to home, older citizens in Liverpool go by a different nickname thanks to their habit of arriving ahead of time to collect their free travel, which begins at 9:30 a.m. They're known as twirlies because they're always a little too early. It ain't over till the fat lady sings. In 1976, an organiser at a basketball tournament was overheard discussing a game that looked to be all over bar the shouting. His exact words were, "The opera ain't over until the fat lady sings." This wasn't, in fact, the earliest outing of the phrase. Regional US English already had several similar sayings that followed the same pattern, including "Church ain't over till the fat lady sings." But it was in the final rousing performance of an opera singer that the expression settled, long before it was picked up in sports commentary. The fat lady in question is usually held to be the Valkyrie Brunhilde in Götterdämmerung, the final epic work of Richard Wagner's Ring Cycle, traditionally played by a woman in armour and horned helmet. Her long and climatic song is about the end of the world of the Norse gods, and so in a very significant way, it really is all over when the fat lady sings.
At Russell's Garden Centre in Baggington, there's a miniature steam train, giving visitors a tour around the centre in small open carriages. Always ready to try something new, of course, Dave went to the Bridgeview Railway for a ride.
Well, hello there. I'm here at Russell's Garden Centre, and this is the Bridge Railway.
Bridgeview Light Railway.
Yeah, excellent. Can you tell me about it, please?
Right, so the Bridgeview Light Railway is run by volunteers. We started it in 2018. It's a 7.25-inch track. That's the width of the track, which is based on the old Victorian person's foot.
Yeah.
So that gives you an idea of how wide or big a Victorian foot was at that time. My feet are bigger. We have four locomotives: Bluebell, Little James, Jubilee, which is a more like a diesel engine, but it's actually a milk floating, very heavily disguised. And Cherrywood here, which looks like the typical steam trains that you saw in America.
Yeah.
On the Grand Pacific.
Yeah.
So you've got your big chimneys, you've got a...
Using a bell, yeah.
Yes.
At the front.
So we have to adhere to track safety regulations as we drive round. So you'll see TSR signs as you go round.
What's TSR?
Track safety regulation.
Yeah.
So we're just like the big boys, we have to be the same.
You do, yeah.
Or maybe they acted the same as us. I don't know, maybe it was copying out. So when we come to the level crossings, we have to go wee-hoo, or whistle, or...
Excellent. And,
but we could do so much, but we do need a little bit more money, and we do need more volunteers to do a bit of this, a bit of that, a bit of the other.
Yeah.
We don't need... Well, we do need train experts, or electricians, or mechanics, but we also need people to run the ticket office, or design our website, or even write some notes, or even, but I never said it, keep all us men in control, because all of us want to do different projects, and what's close to happening is that we're going to get a lot of projects half finished, and not one finished. And I'd like to start some of my projects, but I think maybe I shouldn't start anymore.
No, okay. Maybe not, no.
Maybe not.
How does it seem to be enough?
Yes. So we've got... So we have special days.
Yeah.
Like Halloween's a really popular day.
Yeah.
Where all the staff dress up as monsters and you've got to come along and be scared.
Yeah.
And the tickets for that are sold out before we even start.
Yeah.
Or Christmas, we come along and Santa comes to see us.
Wow.
And he has his own little grotto and his own reindeer. We have had to cancel some weekends because there just wasn't enough people volunteering.
Okay.
So it's all right saying, oh, we've got six volunteers.
Yeah.
But you've got to have somebody in the ticket office. You've got to have somebody in the signal box.
Yeah.
You've got to have... station master, you've got to have a guard, you've got to have a train man, and you've got to have spares for them as well. You can't expect someone to drive all day long without having a break. You can't expect someone to have a guard all day long without a break.
Yeah. I've come along for the Heritage Weekend, the trip on the little miniature railway with member of the Monday Club, Elizabeth. I'm looking forward to the train ride, Elizabeth.
Never been on one of these before.
It'd
be quite interesting.
Ticket office at the moment, so who am I speaking to?
My name's Sarah, and I've been here with the railway for the last 18 months as a volunteer. And my husband is semi-retired, and he drives the train, and signals, and works in the signal box. And I work in the ticket office. And we operate every other weekend during the summer.
Yeah.
And we have special events on Heritage Day. And we have Halloween coming up and Christmas. And then we reopen again just in time for Easter next year.
Wow.
And it's a busy day today. Thank you for coming to see us.
Can you tell us about the engine? It's a blue and yellow engine. Is it based on a diesel or...?
It is based on it's based on a diesel, but it's not a prototype. It's a sort of creation.
Yeah.
It's a company makes them. It's called the Titan Phoenix.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
And we've had it for... about 2 years or so, I'm not sure, but it's our main engine, and we have some others as well that we can use here. This one we're just waiting for some modifications, some air brakes, so that we can use that as well.
That one's the Mauve sort of one, is it?
So this is a new loco to the railway, which hopefully we'll have running very shortly.
That's modelled on a steam engine
with
a bell.
But unfortunately, they're all electric as well.
What's your name?
Richard.
And here comes our train. We're off now. Hey, it's a really nice train ride. There's a blue and yellow engine at the front. It looks a bit like a diesel engine. It's powered by electric, as they all are. And it's the Bridge View Light Railway. and it's the latest thing in Russell's Garden Centre, where there's a secret quarry garden here, and there's lots of plants you can buy, and a cafe. It's a lovely garden centre, actually. But here we are, travelling along. I'm speaking to the guard now, so tell us about the other railways.
Oh. Well, there are several railways in the area. There's a couple in Rugby. There's one at in Coventry on Copse Wood.
Oh, yeah, I've been there.
And there's a very big one in Kingsbury Water Park called Etchill's Wood.
That's wonderful, isn't
it? That's a marvellous railway. It's got steam, diesel, it's got lots of track distance, and it's a real ride on there. It's great fun, great fun.
Okay, so what's your job? You're the guard on the back of the train. You have to wave your flag, your green flag.
I've got whistles. I'm also qualified to drive. I have been driving today.
Yeah.
My wife takes the money in the ticket office and gives out the tickets. Wow. And we also stand on the platform and make sure people are safe before they leave.
Oh, really?
Oh, and look at this on the right. We've got an auto trailer moving around.
Oh, look at that.
So once upon a time that would have taken luggage up and down platforms on rail stations. We've just got that running today just because it's a heritage day and we can show people what went on many, many years ago.
Brilliant, thank you very much. And here we are, we're coming into the station now. Wonderful. Well, so did you enjoy your trip on the miniature railway, Elizabeth?
I certainly did. I didn't realise it was Heritage Weekend. And that was super, absolutely great. Yeah, wonderful.
Right, so thanks a lot, Elizabeth. And that's all from the ride on the Bridge Light Railway at Russell's Garden Centre, Baggington. Bye!
Oh, bye! Bye!
So with steam and smoke bringing back memories of the old steam trains, we end this week's Outlook. So it's goodbye from me, Nigel Hewin, and all the team here until next week.